Welcome to the Fuller Chasing Money Audio Commentary. This is David Fuller on Friday, the 16th of January, and I am recording at 10:35 p.m., and that is Greenwich Mean Time here in London. And this being Friday, this is the big picture long-term outlook for the various asset classes. And, well, it's been an exciting week, hasn't it? So I won't dwell too much on the current activity here, but let's just start with stock markets. The Asian Pacific markets were mixed here today, which is hardly surprising given Wall Street's weakness yesterday on Thursday. Although China, mainland China at any rate, and also India were steady in here today. Now, those markets I've talked about an awful lot, really, for, well, last year and early this year. There is no doubt in my mind that China, and I'm talking now about broader China, not just the A shares, which performed today and have been catching up, but also the HSCEI in Hong Kong and the HSI, the other Hong Kong Hang Seng Index. That whole China region, I think, is cheap. It's attractive. China's a command economy, as we know. So really, the government has to be behind the stock market move, and they have to be creating favorable monetary conditions, and that is just exactly what they are doing. There's a lot of Western sentiment, at any rate, which is sort of worried about China or anti-China. From an investment perspective, that's probably a good thing. It tells you it's under-owned, and I am very happy to be overweight in China myself. I certainly remain very much overweight in India myself, and this market is going to benefit this year with further interest rate cuts. We've already seen one modest quarter point cut from 8 to 7.75 here this week. And their inflation is much lower, not surprisingly. And if China gets a good monsoon, that's in the hands of the weather gods, obviously. But if it does, that will help to keep inflationary pressures lower, and the central bank is likely to be cutting rates. I think even given the uncertainties of a monsoon, I do expect several more interest rate cuts in the Indian market this year. And I think that will help to underpin the recovery that Narendra Modi is creating. So those are my two favorites overall. Looking elsewhere, well, the European markets, which were steadier here today, with the exception of the Swiss market, which fell back, and that's been turbulent recently because of the suspension of the link between the Swiss franc and the euro, which surprised everybody so much. But what we do have, though, is a situation where I think we'll certainly see Mario Draghi, head of the ECB, proceeding with quantitative easing. The Germans are very unhappy about it, and there's talk that they may try to peg that back or fight it in one way or another. But I think Draghi's won the round, and he's been supported by a European court, and that should steady the European stock markets. I think it certainly needs that monetary stimulus, and I'm pretty confident that it's actually going to get it. So concern over Europe, I think, is probably going to ease somewhat here in the months ahead. And again, I just think before I move on to the Americas markets, just people have been talking so much about China's actual slowdown. Well, fair enough. But if it was overheating, I'd be far more worried. and if its economy was overheating. And of course, the government is addressing that economic slowdown with aggressive monetary policies. And that looks good to me. And I've already mentioned that it's a very competitively priced market. Best, most competitively priced one of the majors. Now, turning to the U.S., a lot of uncertainty here. I do have concerns. My long-term view on the United States market is very bullish, not least because of its lead in the accelerating rate of technological innovation. But also because of its virtual energy independence. Those are hugely important factors. I also feel that we've had a pretty tough central government in the United States in terms of the economy and the stock market. You may commend them for some of the other moves that they've taken or other policies that they have initiated and endorsed, or you may not. But I think that in 2016, assuming that Jeb Bush and Hillary Clinton are the two candidates, and that's far from certain at this time, or at least the Republican one probably has more uncertainty. But let's say it is a choice between Jeb Bush and Hillary Clinton in 2016, and that will be good for the economy, I believe, and that would be appreciated by the stock market community overall, by the investment community, and the corporate community. Okay, other factors for Wall Street. I've said previously, so I'll be very brief on this, but that I think people in the fourth quarter of last year were overestimating the growth prospects for the U.S. economy in 2015. The main reason for that was that the oil price was falling. The main reason I feel they were overestimating the U.S. growth was because the oil price was falling, and I think it's unlikely to bounce back quickly, and that really is going to hurt the U.S. economy, because I think something like 40% of capital expenditure last year was going into the energy sector, and that's really going to grind to a halt. We're already getting some inevitable layoffs, and there will be some companies that will need help from their banks, some of the smaller fracking companies, in other words. And so I think in terms of employment and also in terms of capital expenditure, we're going to see that slow a little bit. But I don't think it's a serious problem overall by any means. But what does concern me most about the U.S. stock market is the leverage. Now, I don't know the breakdown of that leverage. I don't know how much of it tends to be among some of the aggressive electronic traders. I don't know how much of it is addressed to the short side of the market. But considering that Wall Street's had a powerful bull market and is now getting all this churning activity up near the highs, although certainly still within the or to the left of the rising 200-day moving averages, which are trend smoothing devices, so that's still important. There's no convincing evidence that that bull run is over, but certainly if we're still in this range a few months from now, we'll definitely have a big broadening pattern here overall, and that will indicate that the risks are increasing. But to return to that leverage factor, the U.S. market has been conditioned to buy the corrections, buy anything that's at a 5 to 10% setback, go in and buy. And of course, we haven't seen anything over 10% or even 10% since 2011. Now, that doesn't cause any problems for the leverage as long as that relationship is continued. In other words, small reactions and buying comes in. That's the leverage doesn't matter. But if we start to get a clearly bigger pattern, and particularly if that is preceded by more sideways ranging, as I mentioned a moment ago, then we could see the unwinding of some of those big leveraged long positions, and that would exaggerate the decline to the downside. And we so we could get a there's a risk that we could get a technical accident there. Would it be ruinous for the economy? Well, I don't see any reason why it should. The overall background for the economy is favorable. Interest rates remain low. Yes, QE is pretty much over, but they're still investing. When I say pretty much, we know they're not doing the big bond buying purchases, but they're reinvesting the dividends on those positions, so that U.S. balance sheet is, or that Fed balance sheet rather, is still still expanding. I think the tightening that people were talking about coming either in the end of the first quarter or by mid-year in 2015, well, that was never my view, and I think it's far less likely the way things actually look here today. Now, Wall Street's performance is going to be hugely important. Well, it pretty much always is. It's the biggest, most highly capitalized stock market. It's also been the leader among developed economies in terms of economic recovery, along with the UK. And if Wall Street just remains reasonably steady, I think some of the Asian emerging markets can do exceptionally well in 2015. On the other hand, if Wall Street's leverage results in a significant slide, that will spread right across the wide range of global markets overall. But I wouldn't exaggerate that risk at this stage. I would just be aware that that's a possibility, and I'd be sensible about leverage, preferably not use much leverage at all. And I think in terms of investment positions, I kind of favor the autonomies and other big other big companies that are doing reasonably well. I haven't reduced my exposure to the stock market overall, and it's increased with dividends and appreciation in here, and I'm happy to hold that pretty much fully invested stance. I've got a little bit of cash which will accumulate with dividends. But I'll reinvest that on setbacks in this market. And I think just in terms of an overall reality acceptance here, and to help keep our nerves steady, I think it's a good idea to just be prepared. Say, I know we're going to have some volatility in here. We will definitely have some more volatility, so that we're not worrying about that waking up in the middle of the night. It's part and parcel of what stock markets do. So if they race too rapidly to the upside, then it's not a bad idea to lighten positions a little bit. And if they pull back really quite sharply, it's a good idea to start nibbling. Okay, buying, in other words, increasing long positions. Okay, what about the government bond markets? Well, I think even the bond bulls are somewhat surprised by how low yields actually are here today. I certainly am very surprised how low the yields are. When I was giving my Markets Now talk on Monday, and I had a long-term chart of the U.S. 10-year Treasury yield, and I said, well, I think this is in the lower side of a basing area, building a base slowly building a base formation here, and we're currently near the Laos. And a delegate said, "Well, it just looks to me like just a persistent, continued downtrend." And somebody else said, "Yes, but we're less than 1.7 away from the zero level." And you don't have a whole lot of additional room to the downside unless you think we're going to go into some huge, horrendous, deflationary, massive slump, recession, depression. Well, I don't feel that way. Certainly not about the U.S. economy. And therefore, we have to say, well, what are markets actually discounting in here? And it's partly the momentum factor, people continuing to reinvest the money. Bonds always had the reputation of being the safer, government bonds, that is, of being the safer investment around. But when yields are this low, how safe are they? Or perhaps the more important question is, are they still a good long-term investment? Well, I don't think so in any other than the most grim of potential outlooks for the global economy, which I'm not looking, which I'm not expecting. So I think I think we will see yields start to push up here later on in the year. But the point I wanted to make is more important than a guess on what those yields will do, but is to say that I think people have really overreacted on the deflation. Yes, there are lots of deflationary pressures, but they're not all negative. And I've talked in the last couple of weeks, I've talked about the positive deflation created by technology. And we are in an accelerated rate of technological innovation. And that definitely makes businesses more efficient, and it makes households more efficient, and it's just that does lower costs overall. And I think though that what it generally means is, you have lower costs, you're able to increase production at lower costs and sell more. And that can be really, really quite positive. So it's not a destructive deflation. I think that Japan, which certainly everybody knows about Japan's deflation, that has been destructive. But their technology is also improving, and they're making a major effort to pull out of that deflationary cycle. And if they persist with that, I think they almost inevitably will succeed. There's deflationary risks in Europe, as we know, but I think Mario Draghi has addressed that. So bringing that back to bond markets, I think they're... it all looks calm and steady and reliable, and people are still making money in there, but this really kind of looks to me like the last minutes of the last hour, as it were. And we're talking about a cycle that's got to be at least 33 years in running, and I don't think we'll be repeated for a very long time. We'll see a partial unwind instead. Okay, in terms of currencies, a big drama on the week, of course, which I've already mentioned, the Swiss franc breaking its link to the euro. The euro remains really quite soft here. That will certainly, it's currently, for instance, it's at 1.1567 against the U.S. dollar. And we have... we have the quantitative easing coming, and that could start before the end of this month. Now, that could very easily push the euro somewhat lower still, and that will help their economy overall. But who benefits best in Europe from that lower euro? Well, it's really Germany. So I do like some of those German autonomies, such as the BMW, where I have a personal position, and also Daimler, any of their big successful manufacturing companies are worthy of consideration for a portfolio, I believe, especially as they have good yields and low valuations overall. But I digressed from that currency situation I was going to talk about. I think the strength of the dollar is now a modest headwind for the U.S. economy. And yes, we'd seen more or less a 40-year bear market for the dollar, although there were some big rallies during that period overall. But I'll put it this way, the dollar's very strong rally that we have seen over the last 6 to 8 months, that's come off a very low base. But nevertheless, it was a rapid move, and that will hurt a little bit in terms of overseas earnings that are then recorded in U.S. dollars, and problem does not really exist anywhere else. I mean, some countries can withstand a stronger currency better than others, and the U.S. is in a better position than it has been previously. So I don't think it's a serious problem, but it is. I've described it as a headwind. I will leave it there. We've had a little bit of steadying recently in some of these Asian Pacific region currencies, not least the Indian rupee, which remains quite steady here overall. Will we see the Australian dollar move a little lower? Quite possibly. Certainly, while the resources prices are weak, and that would help their economy somewhat. I think also we could still see the yen move a little bit lower overall. I kind of suspect, and I have to confess, there's also a hope behind that we don't get too much volatility in the currency markets. I had a concern, and many people have had the same concern, that the dollar's strength might cause some problems with some of the emerging markets if they had borrowed too much in U.S. dollars to use in within their own economies and may have difficulty repaying that. Some of the resources producers under pressure today could easily be in that position, and so that's something to watch out for as the year develops. Now, in terms of commodity markets, it's really quite interesting. Precious metals, you know about those big U.S. investment banks that were talking gold down to somewhere between $1,000 and $800. Well, it's pretty firm in here at $1,280 today, and it has broken its progression of lower rally highs. It has also confirmed a failed break to the downside that it saw last year, and that improves the odds of a recovery. And silver, as I speak tonight, silver is closed at $17.75. You know, it wasn't all that long ago. What was it? Two, three weeks, I think, that we saw that down at $15.50. So that's a good bounce back up here overall. And I feel that is quite a clear indication that the risks for precious metals, which will remain volatile for sure, not least as the dollar is strong in here, but I'm looking at dollar prices. These precious metals have been appreciating here recently against the background of that appreciating dollar. I think the hard money realization has reappeared in the markets generally. The historic value buyers, India, China, they're certainly present in here. I think a mantra that I've long had, though, in the precious metals is don't pay up for them, pick them up after setbacks. And another reason to do that is that you've got a lot of algorithms that firms are using to trade these things. And if they start to see short-term overbought signals on their stochastic indicators, and if the rally momentum then begins to wane, those systems kick in and short, and that creates the volatility. And then you get overextended on the downside into the oversold positions, then they reverse and go long. Well, that there's plenty of that that's going long, that going on, and that you've seen and that I've seen. But I'm happy to say here today that I think when you get those short-term indicators oversold for gold and silver and platinum, those are the buying opportunities for at least trading rallies. And I think the precious metals will be higher at the end of the year than they are right now. And I think that the big bear market is that we've seen is almost certainly ending. What about crude oil prices? Well, I think we're all surprised, or I certainly am, that they fell as low as they actually have fallen. And that was a forecast, you may recall, that I was had leaving. I was just saying that we would see energy prices lower in real terms, certainly before the end of this decade, and it happened sooner. And I think currently we could see some bottoming. We may be beginning to see some bottoming activity in the oil in the oil markets. Now, will we get? They've been so consistent on the way down. I don't think we've seen a rally of more than $5 for either the Brent or the WTI. Both are up in here today, incidentally, and they're sitting about $5 off their lows that they saw earlier this week. So to repeat that point, I don't think we've seen more than a $5 rally for a good many months in the precious metals. And when we do get a rally that is clearly stronger, say $7, $8, $10, that will mark a clear departure from what we've seen throughout this whole persistent downward trend that has actually occurred. Now, that would probably indicate, I'm just going to stop and have a quick drink of water. Hold on. Okay, I said hold on. I mean, what else are you going to do? Oh, you could hang up, but hopefully you haven't. When we see $8 to $10 rally here, that would certainly indicate that we were getting some short covering, and I think there are quite a few shorts in the market overall. Usually, when you get a very, very persistent trend to the downside, it can end in a V shape. In other words, it just keeps going down and then turns around and just moves up as quickly. But very often, you get a what we call a penultimate low. It'll lose its downtrend consistency with a bigger short covering rally that I just mentioned, but not be enough to get to bring in heavy demand and then move lower still. I don't think these are just going to go straight down and then straight back up by any means. It's part of the reason for that is because all of these countries that are desperately in need of oil revenues, these all of these countries that are very dependent on oil exports, I should say. I'm thinking particularly of Venezuela and Russia, but there are plenty of others as well. Now, their first response to the weaker price has been to produce even more of the stuff. And there are no restraints on them, and they certainly from OPEC, and they certainly need the money. Now, I don't think that's going to end quickly, that situation. But more importantly, looking at the future, how far can it go back to the upside? Well, I think I've said it repeatedly here recently that this is a significant game changer. This has been an historic period here in terms of the overall outlook for the oil market, energy prices in general, and also OPEC's control over the oil market. So we're not going to see anything like the spike that we had in 2008 that caused so much damage. And we're up over $140 a barrel. And I think that the $100 level, to achieve the $100 level would require something fairly scary in terms of in terms of output. You know, it would take some kind of bigger challenge to in terms of limiting oil production overall than the Middle Eastern wars and endless conflicts that we've seen over the last couple of years. They haven't been able to push the oil price up sharply. So it would take something really dramatic, I think, to get a significant recovery in the oil price. I don't think that will happen. I certainly hope it doesn't happen. So I think, you know, you get up into the $60 to $80 region, maybe you get speculative action and temporarily move up to $80, $90, but I think that's pretty much it, and I don't think the market will be able to hold it. And I think the big factor here is that technology has enabled us to produce more oil more effectively, and you start getting back up above $60, $70, and that activity will start up again. Certainly if the prices stay up there for more than a week or two, people who produce the fracking supply in the United States, they'll certainly be thinking about increasing their drilling once again. And therefore, supply could increase once again very, very quickly. I don't think that OPEC will be able to reunite that group and its control over that group. So that's good news overall for the global economy. And today's oil prices are good news overall for the global economy. The only difference is that the benefits are widely spread, and they don't translate immediately into economic growth. In other words, lower gas prices, gasoline prices. All consumers are very pleased to see them, but that doesn't mean that they're going to rush out and spend the money that they've saved on the cost of gasoline. It doesn't mean they'll rush out and spend that immediately. But over time, it's a huge stimulus. No doubt about it. And that is good for global GDP growth overall. So then just staying with energy for a little longer, I mean, solar panels, every year they're becoming more efficient, and more countries are importing them or producing their own solar panel systems, and this is spreading among the renewables. Solar is the big one, immensely flexible, and it has really unlimited potential. People say, well, you know, the sun only shines half the day or whatever, which of course is true, but as they become more efficient, they produce more energy, which can of course be stored stored overnight in those panels. But solar is huge among the renewables, and much, much more cost-effective and efficient than windmills. New nuclear will certainly be making a comeback over the longer term. And all of these factors will contribute to what I believe will and have long maintained will be a secular bull market, as in very long term, secular bull market. I'm far more nervous about the next 2 or 3 years, because I think we need to get beyond the normalization of the interest rate cycle. But that will actually occur. And then I think that the combination of technological innovation, that is the big one. I couldn't say enough about that, but you already know a lot about that. And lower energy prices, of course, created with the help of that technology. Those are the two big kickers for that secular bull market. It doesn't mean that it always goes up, because markets get expensive and then you get some sharp setbacks. But we will see, I think, a replay of that secular bull market that took place between 1982 and also up into 1999. And before that, the secular bull market started a little after World War II and ran into the mid-1960s. So that's ahead of us. And it'll be driven by, just to repeat very quickly, technology. That's the really big one. Lower energy prices. That's the second most important one, and created by technology. Then we have the triumph of capitalism, which we certainly didn't have back in 1982, let alone after World War II, in terms of virtually all economies now using capitalistic economic systems, whether democratically led or command economies like China. And then we have the rising middle classes, rising global population generally. We have globalization, which develops those economies much more quickly than we've seen in the past. That also creates some disinflationary and deflationary pressures, as we've already experienced and know about. But the net effect is very positive, and we will see stronger growth, stronger corporate growth. The autonomies will do best of all. And it's a good story overall. That's the more distant future. This year, be prepared for volatility. Be prepared for volatility over the next few years, not least because of that leverage. Will we see another crash like 2000 and 2008? Not for quite some time, I maintain. And on that note, well, it's been an exciting week. It's been a tiring week. You're entitled to have a fantastic and restful weekend, if the two can be combined. All the very best.